is Craig Brown, and welcome to Passages. Passages is a space to explore Bible passages used for preaching, reflection, and prayer. My hope is that Passages will shine a unique light on text used for preaching here at the First Free Methodist Church of Seattle, or for anyone looking to dive deeper into the Bible. Today's passage is Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 to 46. This passage from Matthew's Gospel is the basis for the sermon at First Free Methodist Church on March 26, 2023. It's the fifth message in our Lenten series called Lost and Found, about how we find hope when we feel most lost. The parable here in Matthew chapter 25 is an important one. It is the final parable that Jesus speaks as part of his public ministry. And as a matter of fact, it really is the conclusion of his public teaching ministry. There are four parables Jesus tells in a row here at the end of Matthew 25. And this one from verses 31 all the way down to verse 46 is the final parable. It's quite well known. It's called the parable of the sheep and the goats, and it's usually referred to as some parabolic teaching surrounding the final judgment of all people. Take note in verse 31 where it says, "But when the Son of Man comes in his glory." The title Son of Man is often used in the Gospels interchangeably with Son of God, and oftentimes people get confused between what the two mean. The Son of God obviously is intended to convey this idea that Jesus is the begotten of God. But what does Son of Man mean? There's a little bit of a nuance here in that the Son of Man is a term lifted dominantly from the prophet Ezekiel, and it refers to that which is fully human, in this case, Jesus being fully God, Son of God, but also fully human. He, in every way, represents the fullness of humanity. So it makes sense that when the Son of Man comes in his glory to judge all people, the metaphor matches, Son of Man judging all people. And so what we want to understand at the beginning of this parable, it says that all the nations, in verse 32, will be gathered before him, and he will separate them one from another, just as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. So there is a separation that goes on here, but let's capture first all nations gathered together. The vision here is of every person from all time. It's not simply just those in a particular moment in time, but it has to do with the gathering together of people from all time. And there's a separation on the right and the left, the sheep on the right, the goats on the left. So we shouldn't overly analyze what right or left mean. Both have significance. One isn't necessarily bad and the other one good. It just simply means that they're separated into two different groups. Now, in the parable itself, sheep and those who raised sheep understood them as having a different kind of sustainability. They had wool, they had skins, they had meat, they had even milk. Whereas goats, on the other hand, typically were well known for skins and meat, occasionally their own milk. Sheep were regarded as a kind of sustainable animal, if you will. In some ways, I won't say superior animal, but a more profitable animal for many shepherds. And shepherds usually, in the time of Jesus, ran sheep and goats together. And from a distance, they were a little difficult to tell apart. But up close, of course, obviously, you could tell the difference. And their separation was usually unnecessary. Shepherds would run sheep and goats and didn't really ever have a need to separate them. Even when sheep were shorn, they would simply be separated one at a time for the shearing, rather than separating all the sheep from all of the goats. Now, the one time in which they might be separated was at the end, if you will. In other words, when the sheep or the goat is going to be prepared to be butchered to be used for meat, at that point they might be separated. But up to this point, it's unusual that they would be separated at all. It helps us uncover a bit of the first key passageway here for us, in that as Jesus is explaining this notion of justice, that justice from God requires judgment. We're going to return to this idea later, but take note that there is a judgment. There is this image that Jesus wants us to hear in this parable in verses 31 and 32, and even leaning into verse 33, that there's going to be a time in which there's going to be this separation of like a shepherd would separate sheep from goats. Now, this text is the most direct explanation Jesus offers throughout all of his teaching about what final judgment looks like. There's no other place where Jesus speaks to it quite as clearly as he does here. So to believe in some ways that God's justice doesn't require judgment is to miss something. So the question, though, is, and we want to hold this question carefully, is how will this judgment be done? What's the criteria for it? Who's being judged? So for just a moment, hold on to those questions as we look deeper into what this parable has to teach us. The parable, in many ways, is a separation of the qualified and the unqualified. The sheep, on the one hand, being qualified, the goats being unqualified. And remember, sheep and goats are metaphors for the separation that takes place between all of the nations into two different groups. It says that those on the right are the sheep, and they're going to inherit a kingdom from the foundation of the world. So there's a lot here to understand, that they're invited to come and to inherit this reward from the foundation of the world. The come is an invitation. To inherit means this is like an estate gift from God. This isn't just a gift. This is an inheritance given to those who are children. So this lines up with Jesus' notion of Son of Man at the beginning of the parable, that in a sense, by coming out on the right side of this judgment, you find yourself as a Son of Man with Jesus and Son of God then. And then there's this idea of the foundation of the world. It says in verse 34 that you'll inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. And when it talks about this foundation, it's really trying to reference a restoration to creation and how the world was itself created at the beginning. It's putting things back in some ways in the way in which they were. But what's the criteria? How do you decide what's the qualified and the unqualified? Who comes out on the right side of this judgment and who comes out on the wrong side of this judgment? And Jesus says that I was hungry and you fed me. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was clothing, you gave me something to wear. I was sick and in prison and you visited me. That's the criteria. There's six criterias: hungry, thirsty, stranger, clothing, sickness, and prison. And so there's this ethical and moral imperative around those things. It's not so much that we just saw Jesus in any of those conditions, but that we fed, we quenched, we welcomed, we clothed, and we provided companionship. But what's interesting, not just about the criteria for judgment, because it seems like in many ways that if this is some kind of final judgment at the end of all time for people, and that believers and unbelievers are being judged by this, it somehow seems a bit odd that all of a sudden the judgment is rendered based on the capacity to render mercy and compassion to other people. That absent here in this story is any notion of salvation by faith alone in Jesus Christ. There's no sense in which we experience Jesus' salvific death and resurrection. It's simply about, did you do these things as a moral and ethical imperative? And the question about this is all the more important because when Jesus tells those who are coming into this kingdom prepared from the foundation of the world, they say in verse 37 that the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you or thirsty and give you something to drink? And they continue to go on through all the six different criteria. That the righteous, according to this judgment, never saw any of those things happen. They never had a moment in which they felt like they participated in that. They didn't even remember doing them. There's this complete lack of awareness on the part of the righteous, and as we're going to learn in a minute, on the part of the unrighteous, that they had no idea that they were ever encountering Jesus in those who were hungry, thirsty, a stranger, those in need of clothing, sick, who were sick or in prison. And what Jesus tells them is that the very presence of Jesus himself was in their midst in these things. So when they ask these questions, when did we see you in any of these conditions? It says in verse 40, the king will answer and say to them, Truly I say to you, to the extent that you did it for one of the least of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did it for me. And so let's take that apart a little bit. When it talks about least, it's important to note that the way Jesus uses the word least throughout the Gospel of Matthew, at least, is it often refers to a child, refers to a young person, the least, the lowest ranking, if you will. And then there's this idea of if you did it to one of the least of these brothers or sisters of mine. Now, there's lots of discussion on this by scholars about who the brothers and sisters are. What is that Christian community? Is that the way in which we regarded strangers? Who are the so-called brothers and sisters of Jesus? Tons of discussion on that amongst scholars. And then Jesus finally concludes by saying, if you did it to one of these brothers or sisters of mine, you did it to me. So there's a way in which those brothers or sisters represent the very presence and embodiment of Jesus in some way that was completely secret and unknown to the people who were rendering these acts of mercy and compassion. The parable itself is fairly straightforward between those who either did those moral and ethical imperatives, feed, quench, welcome, clothe, provide companionship, and those who did not provide those things. But what's odd is that no one, neither the righteous nor the so-called unrighteous or the wicked, they had no idea they were rendering any of these works unto Jesus himself. That opens up a key passageway for us, that judgment, the way Jesus is talking about it here, is based on embodiment. It's based on embodiment. And let me explain what I mean by that. Take note that Jesus explains how he's embodied in those that are served. He says, to the extent that you did it to one of the least of these brothers or sisters, you did it to me. Jesus is saying that somehow his very presence is in the least of these brothers or sisters. So a common interpretation of this parable focuses then on justice making, the work of feeding people who are hungry, quenching those who are thirsty, welcoming those who are strangers, clothing those that are naked, providing companionship to those who are sick or those who are in prison. And this takes it a step further to point to serving Jesus in the midst of that Christian community, that Jesus is present in the needs of all those people. So every time we're presented potentially with a hungry, thirsty person or a stranger or someone in need of clothing or sick or in prison, we're actually ministering to Jesus himself. So what Jesus is trying to say, the judgment in many ways is that the doing of faith, in other words, the rendering of acts of mercy and compassion, is tantamount or is equal to actually having faith. So in some ways, what Jesus is explaining in Matthew 25 goes along with what we read in the book of James, that faith without works is dead. But there's still some lingering questions here, like why are both the qualified and the unqualified, in other words, the righteous and the wicked, why are they unaware of what they have done or even not done? How do we address some of the questions that still lurk when we read this passage of Scripture? Well, I'd invite us perhaps to do some wondering about this parable. Now, the usual interpretation is what I've described so far, that at the end of time, God's going to gather all people together, Christian believers, Gentiles, everyone together, and there's going to be a judgment. And the judgment that Jesus renders is based on how well people embodied the moral and ethical imperatives that this parable is explaining to us. But what I'd like to do just for a moment is to hear the minority report. In other words, another way to interpret this parable that is very different than what we're normally used to thinking of. So how can we possibly explain that both the sheep and the goats, the righteous and the unrighteous, had no idea that they were welcoming Jesus himself? So let me just put in front of you some what ifs. What if the nations at the beginning of this parable are actually not Christians? What if it were everybody in sense who is not Christian, that all the nations will be gathered before him? That word for nations is peculiar in that it's referencing all those of otherness, if you will, that are gathered together. So maybe another what if is, what if the little ones of my brothers and sisters, what if those are the apostles and disciples who've been sent out as missionaries to the nations? And so the judgment here is about how others are judged based on how well they welcomed Christian missionaries. Missionaries who were sent with very little. Remember Jesus' story about sending out the 12 and sending out the 70 that we read about in the Gospels, that he tells them, don't take any tunic, don't take a purse, don't take anything with you. Just go as you are, go to a city. If they welcome you, great. If they don't welcome you, wipe the dust from your feet and move on. But interestingly enough, with this minority report or this other interpretation of the parable, we're invited to call to remembrance Matthew chapter 10, verses 40 to 42. And Jesus says this, "And whoever gives one of these little ones a cup of cold water because he is a disciple, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward." What if this parable is about how non-Christians are judged based on their welcome of Christians? This would then help us understand why there's some ignorance about whether or not we welcomed Jesus. So in this particular parable being interpreted like this, missionaries are the ones being sent out. In other words, the apostolic mission of the church being sent into the ancient world, and that the nations either receive those missionaries or don't, and that this final judgment is about how they received them. So, and that in receiving them, they're actually welcoming Jesus himself as embodied in those apostles and disciples who went forth into Christian mission. Then what that would do is help us to understand and explain the whole unawareness that people had about whether or not they were either welcoming Christ or clothing him or quenching his thirst. So rather than Christians being called in the original interpretation to serve a hidden Jesus and being unaware of their good deeds and almost sounding like that we're justified by our acts and our works, could this parable be about the judgment of those who welcome Christian missionaries and how well they welcomed those sent forth into the world in Jesus' name? After all, Jesus, in the earlier parables in this chapter, remember, this is the fourth of four parables in this chapter. In the other parables, Jesus has already made it clear how Jews and Gentiles are to be judged. Now, I'm not sure I totally agree with this different interpretation, but it does solve a couple of problems that we have sometimes when we read this text. It's just something to wonder about as we read this parable and try to interpret it in a new and sort of a different light. It opens the final key passageway to us, that the parables of Jesus are always in context. So we have to learn and to read and even interpret these stories of Jesus in his own context. There are two very different ways of reading this parable that we've talked about in this podcast today. One, the traditional way of reading this parable as a teaching about the final judgment of all people, including Christian believers. And then another interpretation, that this parable is really about the judgment upon people based on how well they welcomed Christian apostles. Even though there's two different ways we might interpret this parable, is it possible that there's even a third or a fourth that we haven't even thought of yet, that we wonder about as we kind of hold this story? So holding these different interpretations and considering them and thinking about them is somewhat part of the mystery. And I would suggest that if anyone claims certainty with exactly how the parable is to be interpreted, well, at that point, perhaps we should be just a bit cautious and maybe a little suspicious. These are stories in a context with a spiritual meaning. Not only are they in the context of what Jesus was in at the time he spoke them, but these are also in context of the audience to whom Matthew was writing this story. A story written to Christians scattered around the ancient world. Matthew's gospel dominantly written to Jewish communities scattered abroad who were called to be ambassadors of Jesus Christ throughout the ancient world, and to give them an encouragement of Jesus who's firmly grounded in his own Jewish context, but yet that context calls them to go into all the world, all of which is taught in the Gospel of Matthew. These are stories in a context that have a spiritual meaning, and some may disagree with the first interpretation or may even disagree with the second interpretation that I've lifted up today. But regardless, the meaning of the story is not reduced, no matter which interpretation you lean into. Judgment has been made clear, both time, when it happens, and the criteria, how it happens. And it's this notion of judgment that's at the heart of the parable. It's an extension of God's justice in the world, the justice that runs on the economy of love and of mercy and of grace, but is judgment nonetheless. If you have comments or reflections, I invite you to visit my website, revcraig.com. In the upper right-hand corner of that website, you'll see a button that says News. If you click on that, then the drop-down menu, select Podcasts. You can click on this week's episode and leave a comment. I'd also encourage you to visit our church's website, ffmc.org, firstfreemethodistchurch.org, to learn more about Free Methodism and how you can connect with our community. For now, I bid you all grace. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.